All right, so this is Bio 241, and it is Tuesday, October 14th, and we're going to finish up neurophysiology tonight. And we talked about synaptic transmission last time. We talked about the structure of the synapse. Basically, there are two cells at a synapse. What are the two cells called? That's a stimulation on a cell, but at a synapse, well, what the heck? Well, I tell you what. What is a synapse? What is a synapse? It's how neurons communicate with each other, right? It's a structural and functional unit of communication between cells. And you learn that there are two kinds of synapses. There's electrical and chemical, and electrical are very few in the body. Those have direct sodium channels between cells, so sodium current, electrical current, can stimulate neighboring cells. But most synapses are chemical synapses. And so the structure of that chemical synapse, what are the two cells that communicate with each other? What are they called? There's a proximal one and a distal one. Exactly right. There's the presynaptic neuron in front of the synaptic cleft, and then there's a postsynaptic neuron, which is after the synaptic cleft. Okay, so those are the two cells. Well, I'm trying to reformulate things in ways that maybe you haven't heard about it, just to give your brain a little something else to think about. Okay, so there's the presynaptic neuron and the postsynaptic neuron. All right, and what's between the pre and postsynaptic neuron? There's a synaptic cleft. Right. Well, maybe I should find a picture of this thing. Where's a picture of a synapse? Oh, here's a pretty good picture of a synapse right here. Okay. So here's the presynaptic, and here's the postsynaptic cell. The presynaptic cell, this is what, at the end of an axon, so this is a terminal button or bouton terminale or synaptic knob or whatever, different ways of calling this thing right here. And so there's a lot of machinery in the end of this axon. That's why it's a little bit of a swelling. So what kind of organelle do you find in this synaptic knob? Mitochondria. I think I heard mitochondria someplace. All right. What's the job of mitochondria? To make energy for the functioning of this swelling right here, because moving these vesicles around and forming vesicles and putting neurotransmitter in them, and exocytosis, of course, is a form of active transport, so that all requires ATP. So we got to have mitochondria in here, and then it's also swollen because it contains a lot of synaptic vesicles. What's inside of a synaptic vesicle? Neurotransmitter, right? And so here is neurotransmitter, and also requires energy to pump all the calcium out of the cell and sodium out of the cell after an action potential, right? So there's a lot going on right here. So would you guess that nervous tissue, in particular maybe the brain, is that a highly metabolic tissue or organ? Yeah, absolutely, because it requires a lot of ATP, so fortunately there are a lot of mitochondria in here.
Can yes? I ask a question?
Yeah.
Now, where's the gap junction at?
The gap junction we don't have in the chemical synapse. Okay. All right, so remember there are two kinds of synapses. One is chemical, and this is the chemical synapse right here. Gap junctions are what we have in electrical synapses. And we find these tunnels right between cells, so sodium can diffuse or move from one cell into another. And when sodium enters a cell, what is that? Okay, what happens to the electrical potential of the cell as sodium moves into it? It depolarizes. Yeah, it depolarizes, and that acts as a stimulus for this particular cell. If there are voltage-gated channels and it depolarizes to a threshold, then that's going to start an action potential in this neighboring cell. And then when it gets to the next cell, what happens? Gap junction flows into the next cell, and then the next one, and then the next one. So the whole organ is going to be stimulated. A good example of that would be the heart through the intercalated discs. One component of an intercalated disc is this gap junction right here. All right. So this is the structure of a synapse, but you also have to know the physiology of the synapse as well. So what involves some of the physiology? Well, as an action potential comes down this axon, and what are the two main phases of an action potential?
Depolarization
and?
Mm-hmm.
Repolarization. What causes depolarization? This is just a really quick review. Opening of the sodium channels that depolarizes the membrane. Now, in the synaptic knob right here, there are other kinds of voltage-gated channels besides sodium and potassium, and they are calcium. So when the membrane starts to depolarize, these channels change conformation. They open up. Calcium enters because calcium is high on the outside. And then calcium works through the following mechanism we talked about. It binds to calmodulin. That's a regulatory molecule that activates a protein kinase. All right, so protein kinase normally is inactive, but when an action potential comes down here, it becomes active, and that protein kinase phosphorylates a number of proteins inside the synaptic knob, and it will activate them when they become phosphorylated. Those proteins cause the docking of these synaptic vesicles to the presynaptic membrane, and exocytosis of neurotransmitter occurs as a result of that. All right, but don't forget, that all requires a lot of ATP for that to happen. So the molecule, the energy molecule that's necessary is which molecule? For synaptic transmission. The energy molecule that's necessary for synaptic transmission is ATP. The signaling molecule that for synaptic transmission is what? What molecule has to enter the synaptic knob?
Calcium.
Yeah, so think of it in terms of those two processes. All right, and then as calcium enters, that causes release of neurotransmitter. The neurotransmitter goes to the postsynaptic membrane, and it's going to bind to another kind of channel. What kind of channel is it going to bind to? It's not a voltage-gated channel. It's going to be a ligand-gated channel. So when neurotransmitter binds to that channel, one example would be for it to open that channel up for sodium. So sodium can enter the postsynaptic cell. And when it does, what happens to the membrane voltage on the postsynaptic cell? It? Yeah, depolarized. Because whenever sodium enters a cell, that's really the classical definition of depolarization or a stimulus, right? And in this particular case, that would create a graded potential. And if the graded potential is of sufficient voltage by the time it reaches the axon hillock or the trigger zone, then that's going to start an action potential on that postsynaptic cell, right? And then that action potential is going to run down the axon of the postsynaptic cell. So if that postsynaptic cell was a million miles long, what would be the difference in that action potential from the trigger zone to the axon terminus? What would change? Even if that axon went all the way around the sun and back, how would you describe the difference in that action potential from beginning to the end of that axon? There'd be no change. It'd be exactly the same. Action potentials travel down an axon without decrement, no matter how long that axon is. That's one of the really interesting things about how information is transmitted in a biological transmission line, like an axon, because it's self-propagating. All right? All those voltage-gated channels cause the self-propagation of an action potential. All right. Now, what happens to this neurotransmitter once it's in the synaptic cleft? How come it doesn't just repeatedly cause depolarization after depolarization after depolarization after depolarization forever? Okay, because this neurotransmitter, there's two possible fates for it. Sometimes it is broken down by an enzyme. It's degraded in the synaptic cleft, right? And so that stops the transmission. Another way of doing that, sometimes that neurotransmitter is actively taken back up by the presynaptic neuron. At other times, some of this neurotransmitter is taken up by other cells, which are not neurons. What are other cells in the nervous system that aren't neurons? What do we call those? Neuroglia. And in particular, the cell that will take neurotransmitter out of the synaptic cleft is called an astrocyte. So astrocytes sometimes absorb neurotransmitter, which then limits the effect of that neurotransmitter at the synapse. All right, so I have something for you to look at, but I have to get out of this... So don't forget about calmodulin. It's an important kind of protein. What does calmodulin bind? It binds a signal that comes from outside the cell. What does it bind up? What binds to calmodulin? It's in the word. What? Calcium. That's right. Calcium. Right? Because we're going to talk about other cousins of calmodulin molecules that are regulatory proteins and other kinds of tissues. All right. So I guess I got to end the show, but I want to come back to it. And I want to show you this video right here. Okay? This just kind of underscores all the things that we were looking at. So what's this? Action potential coming down, getting to the axon terminus, causing voltage-gated calcium channels to open, right? And that's going to cause the fusing and exocytosis of neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. They're going to bind to ligand-gated channels. They're going to open the channels. Sodium can enter the cell. That causes depolarization, which then starts an action potential, not an action potential, but a graded potential that's going to flow over the cell. I got to play it again because I can't talk that quite that fast. Okay, so calcium is entering, binds to calmodulin, exocytosis of neurotransmitter, binding to a ligand-gated channel right here, opens up the channel, sodium can enter. All right, but now what happens to the neurotransmitter here? It gets broken down. Okay, didn't show that very well. It gets broken down, and then the effect of that neurotransmitter then is stopped so that we can send another signal across the synapse. Okay, so what did I miss? I think that's it pretty much. Do you want to see the animation one more time? Probably not. Yeah. Okay, all right, so here's that action potential. That's going to trigger what? Voltage-gated calcium channels. Calcium is going to bind to calmodulin. That's going to activate some mechanisms inside the terminal button for release of neurotransmitter. Neurotransmitter binds to a ligand-gated channel that allows for depolarization, and that creates a graded potential, which then flows down to the axon hillock. Okay. All right, so don't forget that series of events, but I think it's listed in your PowerPoints pretty much in that exact order. I don't have it on your website. Would you like to see it on your website? Actually, there are a number of animations. Okay. I can put it on Blackboard. I have it on a different Blackboard class, but I can put some other stuff on there. Probably so. Well, that one isn't, but I'm sure this one is. Okay, along with some other synapses. All right, so let's get back to what we were looking at. All right, so don't forget about calmodulin that activates protein kinases. All right, well, there are two different ways that the postsynaptic cell can be stimulated. If the ligand binds to a channel, and that channel is a sodium channel, and so sodium enters the cell, that's going to cause what? Depolarization, which is a stimulus. So when the cell depolarizes, that brings it up more to threshold, right? So that will open a voltage-gated channel. How would you go the other way? What kind of channel could you open if you wanted to hyperpolarize a membrane? Maybe you had a special ligand-gated channel that when the neurotransmitter binds to it, it's going to hyperpolarize the membrane instead of depolarize it. So what kind of membrane channel would you want to open up in that particular case? Okay. As a matter of fact, yeah, potassium. Exactly right. Because when you allow sodium to enter the cell, that causes depolarization. If you allow potassium to leave, that causes hyperpolarization or repolarization. So under certain circumstances, there are receptors that behave that way that are potassium channels, right? So there are two kinds of stimulations that can occur on the postsynaptic cell. And these are EPSPs, or excitatory postsynaptic potentials. So what kind of channel is going to cause an EPSP? There's going to be a sodium channel, a ligand-gated sodium channel, because that's going to cause a depolarization of the membrane. And what kind of channel is going to cause an IPSP, or an inhibitory postsynaptic potential? a potassium channel. So depending on the kind of receptor, it can either act in a stimulatory fashion or an inhibitory fashion on the postsynaptic neuron. Right? And neurons might be stimulated by EPSPs and IPSPs at the same time. What's a neuron going to do if it receives the same amount of EPSPs as IPSPs at the same time? What's the effect going to be? Well, they're going to cancel, and there's not going to have any effect on the neuron. So this neuron is what? Integrating information from various parts of the body. It acts as an integration. This is one way that it can integrate information up, because EPSPs and IPSPs can cancel each other out. All right, so these affect voltage-gated channels in the postsynaptic cell. Now, how can an EPSP or an IPSP affect voltage-gated channels? Where do you first find voltage-gated channels on a neuron? You find them on axons, but where's the first place of the axon? The axon hillock, right? So by the time these EPSPs and IPSPs move to that axon hillock, then they're going to have an effect on either generating an action potential or not, if it meets threshold. Okay. All right, so that's why on this diagram right here, we see integration happens at dendrites and the cell body, because this is where IPSPs and EPSPs merge together, especially here at the axon hillock. That's why we call this the trigger zone. And if a threshold is reached, then that's going to start an electrical impulse or a nerve impulse. What the heck is a nerve impulse? That's an action potential that is moving down the axon, right? Because if you cause depolarization in one part of this axon, that's going to affect voltage-gated channels in the next part. Especially if it's, what, a myelinated fiber, it's going to hop from node to node around the right down the axon. Okay. All right, so here is a pretty nice diagram that says everything that we've been looking at so far. So don't forget, how many neurons are involved in a synapse in the most simplest case? There are two, and what are they called? The postsynaptic neuron and the presynaptic neuron, but you might want to say it the other way around. All right, so here we have a figure. The first gray box right here is the presynaptic neuron, and the second gray box is the postsynaptic neuron. And what is the space between the boxes? That's the synaptic cleft, right? All right, so here is a nice chemical synapse. This shows you a flow diagram of synaptic transmission. Action potentials reach the axon terminus. All right, so that's causing depolarization. That's changing the membrane voltage. That opens voltage-gated calcium channels, which allows calcium to enter the cell. Because where is calcium high? It's high outside the cell, right? So when those channels open up, calcium enters. And that what does it bind to? What does calcium bind to? Calmodulin, that's right. And that's going to change some enzyme activity. It's going to activate a protein kinase, which eventually is going to lead to release of excitatory neurotransmitter. That neurotransmitter diffuses across the synaptic cleft, binds to a ligand-gated channel, or you could say chemically-gated channel, same thing. And we said it was an excitatory neurotransmitter, so what kind of channel is that for what ion? It's going to be for sodium. So is that what we see right here? Oh, yeah, inward diffusion of sodium that causes depolarization, which is what? An EPSP. So an EPSP is a graded potential, and it's going to flow over the rest of the dendrite and the cell body. But as it flows, it loses what? It loses intensity. It becomes lower and lower in voltage. All right? But if it reaches the axon hillock and it's still a threshold, if it reaches threshold voltage, that opens what? Voltage-gated sodium channels. And potassium channels. Which ones are faster, the sodium or the potassium channels? The sodium is faster, so what happens first? Depolarization happens first, and then repolarization happens second because of the potassium channels. And don't forget, then, that's an action potential. Action potentials are self-propagating without decrement down the whole length of the axon. So here's a little synopsis of synaptic transmission. What's the energy molecule necessary? ATP. What's the signaling molecule that enters a cell? Calcium, right. So hopefully now you have a nice impression of calcium. What do you think is more important? Have a lot of calcium in your bones to make your bones strong, or the proper amount of calcium in the extracellular fluid so that you can have synaptic transmission, proper synaptic transmission. Having a nervous system that works. Probably much more important to have a nervous system than to have strong bones. And your body makes that decision for you as we get older, and that's one of the reasons why our bones get or lose calcium. That kind of underscores what you learned in anatomy, and that is that bones are a reservoir for calcium. All the processes in your body that require calcium, they go to bones to find it. And this synaptic transmission is just one example. All right, so acetylcholine is a neurotransmitter. It's the most widely used neurotransmitter. It's used in the brain and in the peripheral nervous system in terms of the ANS. Can anybody guess what ANS stands for? ANS? Autonomic nervous system, right? It's a very important autonomic nervous system neurotransmitter. So brain, autonomic nervous system in the peripheral nervous system, and all neuromuscular junctions. Every single neuromuscular junction only uses acetylcholine. Okay. Now, some neurotransmitters, or a neurotransmitter, sometimes, this is a better way of saying it, one neurotransmitter sometimes can be excitatory in one tissue, and it can be inhibitory in another tissue. How is it possible that one neurotransmitter can have opposite effects in different parts of the body? It's the same neurotransmitter. Like, and so that's just a signaling molecule. That's like for me yelling, say, go, and some of you go and some of you stay. Why is that? How is it that two different actions can happen in your body even though there's only one signaling molecule? As a matter of fact, that's the exact answer. Because there are different kinds of receptors. They maybe have the same binding site, the same shape that will bind acetylcholine, but what happens after that binding is different because the receptor is different. Okay. So in this particular case, acetylcholine has generally two different kinds of receptor proteins in the membrane. Some are called nicotinic and others are called muscarinic receptors. So these are what we call receptor subtypes. And these either can be excitatory or inhibitory depending on the mechanism involved with these different receptors. So let's take a look at these different synapses. And they're different because they contain different kinds of receptors. All right, nonetheless, both are ligand-gated, right? They both are chemically gated kinds of proteins, so that means that acetylcholine has to bind to them. And they're named because this first kind was first discovered as a result of applying nicotine to a certain cell or a tissue, and then watching the effects. So nicotine has the same kind of shape as what molecule? Acetylcholine, because nicotine binds to the active site of that particular receptor. So it doesn't match exactly, but at least there's some part of nicotine that looks a lot like acetylcholine, has about the same kind of shape. Other kinds of receptors are muscarinic receptors. Okay, so I guess maybe I could draw this out. Let's just say that acetylcholine has this kind of shape, and here is the membrane right here, and here is, so here's a ligand-gated channel right here, so that when nicotine binds, what happens to it? It opens up, right? So now you've got this thing over here. All right, so this is what we call acetylcholine. But what else do we see? Let's say for a muscarinic receptor, the compound that can bind to a muscarinic receptor is called muscarin. And muscarin comes from a mushroom. All right, and you might know that most mushrooms are very poisonous. All right, and let's just say that muscarin maybe looks like that. All right, and so where can that bind? This little part, at least this part of the molecule, looks a lot like acetylcholine, and it can bind here, and it's going to poison this receptor. All right, it's not going to allow for this channel to open up, and therefore, when, for instance, if Muscarin is in here. What about acetylcholine? It can't get in. All right, so it's competing for the same site, and it's going to prevent the normal action of acetylcholine. So that's one reason why some mushrooms are so poisonous, because they block these kinds of receptors, and that's muscarin. Okay, so ligand-gated channels contain both neurotransmitter receptor site and an ion channel, and they open when a ligand neurotransmitter binds, right? The ligand is just a neurotransmitter. So here, I'm sure this is an exam figure. This shows us a typical nicotinic acetylcholine channel, right, which has a receptor site on it. So here's, can you see what this is right here? What are these little guys? That's the phospholipid bilayer, right? And we can dissolve various things in this phospholipid bilayer, namely proteins. Here is a protein. This is a transmembrane protein. And a nicotinic type receptor is a very, very long protein, and it actually folds back and forth numerous times across the membrane. As a matter of fact, five different polypeptide subunits have to come together to form this protein. Here's a ligand binding site. But look at this one. How many binding sites does it have for acetylcholine? It's got one and two. And so in order for this channel to open, it requires two acetylcholines to bind to these two sites right here. Okay. Two of the subunits have binding sites. And when acetylcholine binds, that opens up this channel. This channel is very efficient for sodium. It primarily allows sodium to enter the cell. Some potassium leaks out, but by far the major effect is the entry of sodium. And when sodium enters the cell, what do we call that? The depolarization, or in another way of thinking, that what kind of potential is that? Is that an excitatory or inhibitory potential? That produces an EPSP. Right? An EPSP is just a graded potential that then flows down to the axon hillock. Okay, so this is a typical nicotinic kind of receptor, right? But it needs to bind two acetylcholines, and in this case, it produces EPSPs. All right, well, let's look at a muscarinic-type receptor. And muscarinic-type receptors are based on G-protein-coupled receptors. Can you sort of remember what a G-protein-coupled receptor sort of looks like? It's got a receptor site, and the protein goes all the way across the membrane, and then on the inside surface of the membrane, you've got the G protein, which has three subunits to it, and those three subunits can break apart, disassociate, and float around on the surface of the membrane and maybe activate some other kind of mechanism. All right, so for this kind of receptor, the receptor is not part of the ion channel. It just activates the G protein. And it's just a very simple one subunit membrane polypeptide. And this is a very old kind of receptor. Basically, all animal life that communicates through receptors have these kinds of receptors. So, I don't know, think of some kind of animal that's really, really ancient in terms of evolution. I wouldn't even be surprised if sponges, that's an animal, have these kinds of receptors. But worms and flatworms and nematodes and snakes and frogs and everybody else has these kinds of receptors. So we say that this kind of receptor is highly conserved through evolution. All right, so it's a very old, ancient kind of receptor. And we take advantage of it too. Okay, so I'm sure this is an exam figure too. So this is a muscarinic acetylcholine receptor system. And we see that here is the binding site for acetylcholine. So here is the receptor molecule. How many acetylcholines are required to bind? Only one. For muscarinic, it's only one. All right, and when it binds, it activates this G protein. And the G protein then dissociates from the receptor protein right here. And in this particular case, the beta and gamma subunit, well, the alpha can float around on the surface of the membrane, and the beta and gamma can float around, because what can you tell me about this membrane right here? What's a good model to think of? It's a phospholipid bilayer, but a more sophisticated model would be what? Fluid mosaic model, right? It's very fluid. Things can move around, diffuse around, partially dissolved in the membrane right here, and it's a mosaic because we can we can put various kinds of proteins in this membrane. So the beta and gamma subunit will float around and they will bump into this protein here. And when they bump into this protein, it is what? You could consider it a ligand-gated potassium channel. So when the beta and gamma subunit bump into this channel, it changes conformation and it allows for potassium to leave the cell. So what is that going to produce when potassium leaves? Is that going to be depolarization?
No.
Nope, that's not. That is hyperpolarization, but another way of saying that is what? Is that an EPSP or an IPSP? That's an IPSP. It's going to be a graded potential, which is going to be inhibitory. Now, why is it inhibitory on this neuron or this cell? Why is it inhibitory? Because what does hyperpolarization do? Does it move the membrane potential toward threshold or even further away from threshold? Further away from threshold, right? So potassium channels cause inhibition in these kinds of cells. Okay, so here you see how acetylcholine, one signaling molecule, can cause inhibition, because in this particular case of this muscarinic receptor, it's going to cause hyperpolarization. But in a nicotinic receptor, it's going to cause stimulation or excitation because it's primarily a sodium channel that opens up. So one neurotransmitter can have various effects in different parts of the body, all depending on what kind of receptor types the nucleus decides to put into the plasma membrane. And would you agree it's the nucleus that decides that? Yeah, because the nucleus controls the activity of the whole cell. What kinds of proteins are translated, right? Transcribed and translated. All right, so this is just one example. There can be others that cause depolarization. So muscarinic receptors don't have to be hyperpolarizing. In some tissues, they can be depolarizing as well. But they're not going to be a nicotinic type. They're going to be this kind of G protein coupled type receptor. All right, so how's that? Is that sort of making sense about how you can be an IPSP or an EPSP? Well, how is it now that maybe once acetylcholine binds, let's talk about this nicotinic receptor right here. How is it that once acetylcholine binds, that this channel isn't forever open? Okay, how is it that the effects of acetylcholine go away? Because, for instance, once you stimulate a muscle like your biceps, you don't want that biceps contracted for the rest of your life, right? You don't want just one shot at using a muscle. You'd like to use it and have it relax and then use it again and have it relax and use it again. So what stops synaptic transmission or what stops excitation in that effector organ? Okay, inactivation of neurotransmitter. Okay, so there are various ways, but in this particular scheme right here, acetylcholine is inactivated, thus terminating its action, because here you have the postsynaptic membrane. Also embedded in the postsynaptic membrane are other protein molecules, and this one here is called acetylcholinesterase. What can you tell me about this molecule right here? It's an enzyme, and you know it's an enzyme because of the ASE at the end of the word, and it's going to break acetylcholine down into acetate, which you're familiar with acetate already, and choline, which is kind of like a lipid molecule. Where did you run into acetate already? Who can tell me something about acetate? How do little fragments of glucose get into the Krebs cycle? As acetic acid or acetyl-CoA, acetyl groups or this acetate right here is just a two-carbon fragment. Two carbons put together, and if you take probably acetylcholine, I don't know this for sure, I probably should know it, but probably if you take acetyl-CoA with the right enzyme, combine it with choline, and now you've got what? Neurotransmitter, acetylcholine that's then packaged in vesicles. So as a matter of fact, acetate is taken back up by the cell and then it is reincorporated with a choline to make acetylcholine again. But once acetylcholine in the synaptic cleft is degraded to acetate and choline, then that molecule no longer has the proper shape, right, to bind to the receptor, and that terminates the action of the neurotransmitter in the synaptic cleft. Okay, so that's one way that can happen. All right. So what about some other kinds of neurotransmitters? Oh, we're not done talking about acetylcholine yet. Okay. Any kind of, yeah. Yeah, nicotinic
would be the presynaptic. Is that correct?
Well, I'm not sure I'm following how you're thinking.
How you say there's the postsynaptic on the two.
Okay, so here's the presynaptic cell. Here's the postsynaptic cell.
So the nicotinic would be on the presynaptic.
Well, nicotinic is just tells you the receptor types.
Uh-huh.
Okay, on the postsynaptic membrane.
On the
that's down over here. Like okay. This one right here, here's a postsynaptic cell. What does that kind of look like?
Oh, that's
does that look, yeah, it kind of looks like it because there's only one binding site right here.
Oh, so
this would be a muscarinic receptor. So we would say, yeah, this whole synapse is muscarinic in nature because of that receptor.
Okay.
Or if it had two binding sites, all right, and it was actually a channel that could open and close, and that would be a nicotinic type receptor.
Okay.
Nicotinics are always what, excitatory or inhibitory? Excitatory, producing EPSPs. All right, well, we need to talk just a little bit more about acetylcholine. Synapses, all right, actually chemical synapses that are controlled by acetylcholine are what we call cholinergic. The presynaptic and the presynaptic neuron is cholinergic. All right, so we don't say acetylcholine-ly. Or like, or anything like that we just call it cholinergic. So if there's a cholinergic neuron, what is it used as a neurotransmitter? It's going to be acetylcholine. Okay, so cholinergic means acetylcholine. So this choline right here, all right, that's what cholinergic means because it comes from the choline and acetylcholine. One last thing about nicotinic kinds of receptors or cholinergic systems. Remember we said that all neuromuscular junctions rely on acetylcholine. That means all neuromuscular junctions are cholinergic. They're cholinergic. And they're very, very large. And when the axon releases acetylcholine, that's going to produce what kind of EPSP? I mean, if neuromuscular junctions are huge, that's going to produce a really large EPSP. It's going to really depolarize that that membrane. So, and we call these end plate potentials. All right, so we're talking about a neuromuscular junction. What's the effector organ in that neuromuscular junction? In the neuromuscular junction, what's the effector? What's being effected there? Is it cardiac muscle? Is it smooth muscle? Is it a gland? Or is it skeletal muscle? At the neuromuscular junction. It is skeletal muscle. Skeletal muscle. So the neuromuscular junction is the synapse between a neuron and a skeletal muscle. And what are some characteristics of skeletal muscle? Skeletal muscle. It's what? It's long. They're really long fibers. How many nuclei do they have in them? Hundreds of nuclei. What do they look like on the inside? Striated. Okay, I'm just trying for you to conjure some information from the past. What else about skeletal muscle? What kind of control is it under? Voluntary or involuntary?
Voluntary.
Yeah, skeletal muscle is voluntary, right? As opposed to involuntary, like cardiac and glands and things like that. All right. So at this neuromuscular junction, when a nerve impulse comes down the nerve and releases a lot of acetylcholine that goes across the neuromuscular junction and stimulates a muscle fiber, what should that muscle fiber do? Should it sit there and think about whether it should contract? No, because it's just a slave to our nervous system, right? It's under voluntary control. Your brain has control over those muscles. Skeletal muscles should never make up their minds for themselves if they're going to contract, which is a good thing. Because if I'm dying of thirst and I need to take a glass of water and I want to lift it up to my mouth, all right, then I should be able to control that. The muscles shouldn't say, oh, well, you don't want to do that now. Right? That's not the purpose of voluntary muscle in your body. So the point I'm trying to get to is that every time there's an action potential down at the axon terminus, and it causes release of acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction that always, always, always causes an action potential on that muscle. Okay? It always causes an action potential that flows over the muscle that causes contraction. Okay, so there is never a thing like a hyperpolarizing or an IPSP graded potential on a muscle. A muscle can never decide on its own whether it's going to contract when it gets an electrical impulse from a nerve. Okay, so in every case that will cause muscle contraction. I think I made that point. Who knows what I was talking about? When an action potential reaches a neuromuscular junction, can a skeletal muscle ever decide not to contract? Mm-hmm. No, because then you wouldn't have voluntary control over it, right? So that's sort of what I was trying to say. All right, well, for millennia, there were people that knew something about the neuromuscular junction and used it in their almost everyday life. And it's sort of akin to this picture right here, and that is there were Aboriginal people in South America that sort of knew something about these receptors. Okay, so what kind of receptor is in skeletal muscle again? Is it a nicotinic or muscarinic? It's nicotinic. It's always going to be excitatory, right? So acetylcholine has to bind actually two places on that receptor protein before the channel opens. Well, some folks down in South America actually knew, you know, where to find. I guess I'm going to just leave this thing. What is this? This is an inhibitor of this active site right here. All right, and this chemical right here is called curare. So if they could inject curare into an animal that they wanted to hunt, guess what would happen to that animal? Okay, it would paralyze them, right? It would block the neuromuscular junction. And so what they found was this curare. Does anybody know where this curare comes from? Naturally produced. It's found on the slime of certain tree frogs in South America. The really small, brightly colored tree frogs are called poison arrow or poison dart frogs. And so they learned that if they could just cover the tips of some really small arrows and shoot those little small arrows into even like a water buffalo or something, that would kill the water buffalo, and then all you have to do is walk up to the animal, and then you'd have a party for a couple weeks or something, right? Because that's enough food to feed like a whole village. So, curare blocks the action of acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction. Of course, if that gets to the diaphragm, then the animal can't breathe, then that's it. So, those people learned that they could hunt huge, big game with what? Just tiny, tiny arrows, as long as they could get that little nuclear warhead painted on that arrow tip and not poke themselves in the process of hunting and things like that. Okay, so that's really, I think, one of the first medicinal uses that I know of people using knowledge about receptors, right, for their own good. Okay, other kinds of neurotransmitters. Monoamine neurotransmitters include serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. Right, so you should probably know that these three right here are what we call monoamine. What the heck does monoamine mean? Sorry. I mean, there's one amino group, okay, on these neurotransmitters. You probably have heard of these neurotransmitters before. Serotonin is derived from tryptophan. We didn't spend a whole lot of time in here about tryptophan and some of these other kinds of molecules. Maybe we talked about it, I'm not sure. But does anybody know anything about tryptophan? Does that ring a bell at all? It is an amino acid. Okay? And so, what's an amino acid? Yeah. And a carboxyl group. But what's an amino acid used for? Yeah, it's the building block of protein. Okay? So, it's a building block of protein. And remember, I think I did mention this, there are generally two kinds of amino acids in our body. There are amino acids that your body can make all by itself, and then there are amino acids that you can't make all by yourself. What do we call those that your body can't make? Yeah, maybe I didn't talk about it in here. They're called essential amino acids, right? So don't forget, a protein is what? You think of it as a link or a chain with all these different links, and all these different links in a protein are what? Different amino acids. And for instance, maybe this one right here is tryptophan. And if you don't have, and your body can't make tryptophan, right? So if your body can't make tryptophan and you don't have it in your diet, what happens to this protein? You can't make it. And your body is going to be devoid of whatever function this protein is providing for you. All right? So on this slide right here, how is serotonin made? You take tryptophan, and it gets converted into what? Serotonin. And what is serotonin? What's it important for? Synaptic transmission is what I'm thinking of. And melatonin for sleep. Okay, melatonin for sleep. But it's for synaptic transmission. It's how neurons communicate with each other. So, for instance, if you don't have tryptophan in your diet, what happens to serotonergic synapses? What happens to the communication between those cells? That can't happen. So you're losing synaptic transmission in this whole neurotransmitter system. All right, so that's really important to know. Tryptophan is the precursor for serotonin, and it is an essential amino acid. I'll build on that concept a little bit. Norepinephrine and dopamine are derived from tyrosine. And guess what? Guess what about tyrosine? It's an amino acid, and it's also an essential amino acid. Your body can't make that. So unless you have tyrosine in your diet, can your body make norepinephrine and dopamine? Cannot. And those pathways that require these neurotransmitters, right, are going to be degraded. So all of these right here are catecholamines. Catecholamines. Tryptophan. Tryptophan is the precursor for serotonin. And tyrosine is the precursor for norepinephrine and dopamine. And both of those are essential amino acids. All right, so your diet what can your diet affect? It can affect how your whole central nervous system functions, right? Because if you don't have these in your diet, you don't have neurotransmitter, that affects the function or the physiology of your nervous system. All right, so that has some important implications. Okay, well, let's look at a synapse, a monoamine-type synapse, especially for norepinephrine. All right, so we start with tyrosine. That gets converted to DOPA, and that gets converted to dopamine through this metabolic pathway, and then dopamine gets converted into norepinephrine. That's a metabolic synthetic pathway for making norepinephrine, and that's placed in this little glob right here. What's this little glob called right here? That's a synaptic vesicle. Right? Okay. And again, an action potential is going to come down the nerve axon, and that's going to activate a voltage-gated calcium channel. So calcium enters the cell, and that's going to control the docking of this synaptic vesicle. And when it fuses to the membrane right here, that's going to exocytose neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. And of course, then it's going to bind to a receptor protein, and that looks like a G protein coupled receptor right here. And that's going to open up this channel. So norepinephrine is a nice excitatory neurotransmitter in most cases. It's going to cause depolarization or stimulation of the postsynaptic cell. All right, but what's interesting about this slide right here is how norepinephrine is deactivated from this receptor. Norepinephrine is not broken down by an enzyme in the synaptic cleft. It is pumped back into the synaptic knob, right? And we call that process, when the neurotransmitter gets resorbed or pumped back into the place where it came from, reuptake. So that reuptake of norepinephrine from the synaptic cleft causes the termination of the effects on the receptor right here, which then stops depolarization. But once inside the cell, it gets broken down. It gets broken down by an enzyme called monoamine oxidase. All right, and then neurotransmitter has to be rebuilt via this long pathway right here. All right, so monoamine oxidase breaks down norepinephrine. All right, so some, we understand that some clinical conditions, like clinical depression, is a result of some attenuation or some inefficiency in norepinephrine pathways. So one way to potentiate the effects or make the effects of norepinephrine stronger within the neuromuscular, not neuromuscular junction, but at this synapse right here, okay, is to inhibit monoamine oxidase. And when that happens, we presume then that more norepinephrine is packaged in each of these vesicles. So once a vesicle fuses, more norepinephrine is released into the synapse, right? And so that just enhances the effect of norepinephrine or synaptic transmission in these pathways right here. So monoamine oxidase inhibitors will sometimes are used as antidepressants for clinical depression. All right, so here's a little biological basis of kind of a terrible affective disorder that some people have to work through. So that's just what? That's just a nice medical condition, and we understand what's happening at some of these synapses right here.
I have a quick question. When you say that it uptakes the neurotransmitters, like after it spits them out, it takes them back in. Does it just like do that by itself, or is it like the whole thing with the astrocytes that take up the glutamate, turn it into glutamine, and go back into the?
The process is similar. Okay.
It's not like it just goes.
It just doesn't diffuse back in, but there's
some. Something
that puts it back in? Yeah, there are membrane proteins that will sequester norepinephrine and put
so
it back in the cell. They just don't
float
back. Right, they just don't float back. Right. Yeah, monoamine oxidase inhibitors, MAO inhibitors, will enhance the effects of norepinephrine in these kinds of neurons. Okay, so here is another kind of receptor, and you can see this is a nice G protein coupled receptor. So here we have norepinephrine binding to the receptor molecule, which then activates the G protein, and in this particular case, it's not the beta and gamma subunits, it's the alpha subunit that can float around just inside the membrane, and it can bump into this protein here. And you see a channel in this protein. We saw that for the muscarinic receptor, right? There was an actual ion channel that was opened up for potassium, for instance. But this protein in the membrane is what we call adenylate cyclase. And what does that ASC tell you? That's an enzyme. So when the alpha subunit binds to this protein, it's going to activate this enzyme. If the alpha subunit is not bound to it, it is inactive. So when the alpha binds to adenylate cyclase, it activates it. And adenylate cyclase, I think, was an enzyme that I asked you to look at on in that one table of enzymes in the second chapter, I think. Adenylate cyclase catalyzes the reaction of converting ATP to cyclic AMP. So how many phosphates does ATP have?
Three.
How many phosphates does cyclic AMP have?
One.
Only one. But this is a very interesting molecule. Even though it has one phosphate, it still forms a ring. So it has a very specific kind of structure, and so we call it cyclic AMP. Cyclic AMP can take a protein kinase. What does a kinase do again?
Adds a phosphate.
Yeah, it runs around adding a phosphate to certain kinds of molecules. So cyclic AMP can activate protein kinase inside the cell, can activate it, and this protein kinase might phosphorylate an ion channel. And when it phosphorylates that ion channel, it's going to cause a change in conformation. So think of any time when you phosphorylate something, think that somebody's poking you in the side. What's it going to do? It's going to make that protein wiggle or change conformation, right? And so now this ion channel opens. And tell me something about this ion channel. If it produces an EPSP, what kind of ion channel is it? Yeah, it's excitatory. But what kind of channel? It's a sodium channel, and if it produces an IPSP, it's a potassium channel. Okay, so just depending on how the cell determines what channel should be put into this membrane right here, all right, this protein kinase can also phosphorylate other kinds of proteins inside the cell, and this is a way of activating or deactivating metabolic pathways inside the cell. So this is a way of changing metabolism inside the cell. All right, so in this particular case, adenylate cyclase, when it converts an ATP into cyclic AMP, what happens to adenylate cyclase? Does it get used up during the reaction? What can you tell me about an enzyme? It's a catalyst. It doesn't get used up, right? So it can catalyze this reaction over and over and over again, and it stays active. Okay, so cyclic AMP is what we call the second messenger in this particular system, right? And once adenylate cyclase gets activated, right, it can produce thousands or tens of thousands of cyclic AMP molecules inside the cell. But what was the initial signal for producing thousands of these cyclic AMPs inside the cell? What was the initial signal? Okay. It was the binding of norepinephrine to this receptor. So how many norepinephrines have to bind to this receptor to produce thousands of cyclic AMPs? Only one. All right. So the signal outside of the cell is norepinephrine. The signal inside the cell is cyclic AMP. So we call cyclic AMP the second messenger. The first messenger is what we call norepinephrine. So the first, where does the first messenger always stay? It stays outside the cell. It doesn't have to enter the cell, but it works through this G protein coupled receptor to cause the development of this second messenger, right? But only one molecule of norepinephrine was necessary to create thousands of molecules of cyclic AMP. Right, so what do we call that process of starting with something really small and then making it really large? Okay. Well, I do this on my radio all the time. Right, I take a really small signal and I make it bigger and bigger and bigger. That's amplification. Yeah, so that's what I want you to appreciate here. So this system, this G protein coupled system, can take one really small molecule or one really small signal and change it into a really huge signal. So that's amplification. That's one thing that's happening right here. So not only is the signal going from outside the cell to inside, all right, so what do we call that process? I don't know if your book does a really good job with this. All right, that's what we call signal transduction. So again, what's signal transduction? Taking some kind of signal that's on the outside of the cell and converting it into a signal that's inside the cell. People had no idea how that happened for a really long time, and then a lot of really smart people earned a lot of Nobel Prizes for figuring out what was in the membrane that was taking the signal outside the cell and converting it into something inside the cell. Okay, and signal transduction in this scheme is accomplished by what we call the second messenger. What's the second messenger in this scheme right here? It is cyclic AMP. And again, what happens? There is a stage of amplification. One signaling molecule outside the cell can produce thousands of signaling molecules inside the cell.
So that one is also known as that camp. You don't put the cycling.
Cyclic AMP?
Yeah.
CAMP.
Okay.
Yeah. With a little c. Little c AMP.
Okay.
Yeah. That means cyclic AMP. All right. Well, what else is happening here? Cyclic AMP can activate this enzyme. And when this enzyme right here phosphorylates something, does it go away? No. That enzyme doesn't get changed. So this enzyme, right, so can catalyze this reaction thousands of times too. So there is what? Another amplification taking place. So one little signal here can create thousands of cyclic AMPs, which then can, for each one of those thousand, can catalyze thousands of other reactions inside the cell. So we have two levels of amplification. And this kind of mechanism where one thing changes another, we call that a cascade. So with signal transduction in this scheme, I think I would like you to see amplification taking place and also a cascade. And what does that cascade mean? That at each one of these steps, there's amplification taking place. So one tiny little molecule outside the cell can cause, what, a huge response inside the cell. So why is it that one signaling molecule outside the cell can cause a huge change in metabolism inside the cell? It's because of amplification and cascade mechanisms inside the cell. Cascade and signal amplification. And that amplification takes place because, what, that enzyme doesn't go away when it catalyzes one reaction. This enzyme doesn't go away when it catalyzes one. If it only catalyzed one reaction, then there wouldn't be any kind of amplification. But remember, enzymes don't get used up when they catalyze a reaction. So things can happen very rapidly with this kind of mechanism. Okay, serotonin is involved in the regulation of mood, behavior, appetite, even cerebral circulation. LSD is structurally similar. What does that mean? LSD. You guys don't even know what LSD is, but let's just say it's a chemical. Okay. What does it mean if it's structurally similar to serotonin? What does that mean? LSD can bind to the receptor sites or the active sites that serotonin does, right? And then it's going to produce, right, the effect of serotonin on that neuron. And in this particular case, it will be hallucinogens or hallucinations. Okay. There are some neurons, some serotonergic neurons, that are involved with depression as well as norepinephrine. Okay, and there are some drugs that work with these neurons, namely Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, Luvox. These are all serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors. So that once serotonin is released from the presynaptic neuron, these drugs potentiate the effects of serotonin in the synaptic cleft because it blocks reuptake of serotonin. So that just enhances synaptic transmission at these serotonergic synapses. And that has a lot of clinical benefit to some people. So they block reuptake of serotonin, thus prolonging its action in the synaptic cleft. Okay. Dopamine. What do I want to say about dopamine? Okay, dopamine. There are two main dopaminergic systems in the brain. The nigrosubstantial originates in the substantia nigra, and the substantia nigra is part of the basal nuclei. And most textbooks still call it basal ganglia. Maybe you've heard of basal ganglia. It's deep inside the cerebral hemispheres. These are involved with motor control. They inhibit motor activity because muscles, by their nature, have a tendency to contract and become very rigid. But in order for you to move, what do antagonistic muscles have to do? Like if you want to contract your biceps, you can really only contract your biceps when what happens to your triceps? It has to relax, right? If it contracts or it stays rigid, you can't use your biceps. Or if you do, it's just a very awkward kind of motion, okay? And that awkward kind of motion is very evident in people with Parkinson's disease, okay? They have troubles with gait. They have tremor, and that's because there is damage to the dopaminergic system in the basal nuclei. And somebody can get Parkinson's disease later on in life for various reasons. We're not really sure why it happens to some people. There could be family ties, you know, genetic reasons. It could be things in their environment, right? And there can also be early onset of Parkinson's disease, which is relatively rare. But for instance, if you experience head trauma, like motorcycle accidents, car, automobile accidents, or whatever that damage the basal nuclei, that could produce an early onset of Parkinson's disease. All right, so how does somebody look when they're out in public with Parkinson's disease? This is, I think, important for you to, yeah, their gait is unstable. It actually looks like they're, what, intoxicated because they can't stand still, right? They look, well, drunk, for instance. And what would you say about maybe your physiology instructor if they came to class one day and they were drunk? Would that be appropriate or inappropriate behavior?
Yeah,
very inappropriate behavior, right? Okay. And so, anyway, that kind of inappropriate behavior, patients get classified into a drug seekers, and they're dangerous, they're difficult to treat, right? And so anyway, when you see somebody that maybe looks intoxicated, you got to be really careful that they're really not a drug seeker or an alcoholic, because they might be suffering from Parkinson's disease. So don't ever treat anybody really terribly because you think they're an alcoholic when they're really suffering from Parkinson's disease. And one person in particular had an early onset of Parkinson's disease due to head trauma. And he was a real famous person. Anybody know who I'm talking about? Well, Michael J. Fox, this is true, but also, but not the head, Michael J. Fox probably didn't get it from head trauma, at least as far as he knows. He can't remember any incidents. It is Muhammad Ali, okay? And how did he get head trauma? Oh, from fighting these huge, incredibly strong people, boxing them in the ring, right, would hit him in the head, not very often, but I guess often enough to damage the basal nuclei. And so he sort of looks like he's intoxicated, but his cognitive function is what? Absolutely normal. It's just a motor control. He just doesn't have the proper motor control over his muscles anymore, okay, because of head trauma. And that could happen to us, too, in automobile accidents or whatever. And Michael J. Fox is another interesting case. That was early onset. And usually when people have early onset Parkinson's disease, it's due to drug abuse. Right, if you can't identify a traumatic incident, it's drug abuse, because there are certain drugs that might have the same shape as what? As these dopamine receptors in the basal nuclei, and they can poison these receptors. And maybe later on, sometimes this week, you can do a Google search on frozen addicts. Right, there were a number of addicts, heroin addicts in Britain, I think in the 50s, 1950s, that got a hold of a batch of heroin that was improperly synthesized or treated, or however you make heroin, I'm not really sure. It's mostly a natural product, but somehow somebody was fooling around with it, and it had a lot of contaminants in it, and those contaminants bound to receptors in the basal nuclei, and those addicts were frozen for the rest of their lives because the basal nuclei are involved with motor control. So just like Muhammad Ali, completely normal cognitive function, could think, but they just couldn't respond anymore to their environment. They were just in the hospital completely frozen for the rest of their life. So that kind of underscores what? The importance of knowing these receptor systems and the agonists. That means how different ligands can bind to them and cause all kinds of strange effects inside the body. So it can explain a lot of disease processes, but also how we like to treat disease processes. All right, so I'm not going to talk about the mesolimbic dopaminergic system, but you can kind of read through that a little bit. But the interesting about Parkinson's disease. Oh, so Michael J. Fox, I didn't finish that up. Okay, how did he get his Parkinson's disease? Well, it's very rare. Huh? Drugs, it's probably drugs. Probably used drugs, but, you know, he never admitted to that. He said, never did I ever do anything like that. And he's, you know, a really upstanding, good Canadian citizen.
How do you know that?
So, yeah. Well, because he's a Canadian citizen, I know. Okay. But there was something interesting, too, and that is one of the TV sets that he was on was Family Ties, right? And there were some other people that were child actors on that TV show that came down with early onset Parkinson's disease as well.
Yeah,
and so what the common suspicion is now, you know, that kids don't like to behave very well on schedule, especially the filming schedule where you might film for 12 hours or 18 hours a day, that they were actually given drugs in soda pop or Kool-Aid or something that had some contaminants in there that poisoned their basal nuclei, unbeknownst to the people that were on the set. Okay, so that is just sort of interesting information, how it affected the basal nuclei. How does, well, now don't forget, a neurotransmitter can have different effects in the body depending on what? Different kinds of receptors. Some receptors are stimulatory, some are inhibitory. And in order for you to be normal, what do you have to have? is the balance between the excitatory and the inhibitory neurotransmitters. So, for instance, if it's so overactivity of some kind of receptors might be inhibitory receptors, right, which will then somehow maybe affect the reticular activating system, somehow divorce you from what you see, and you know what the reticular activating system is. It's a reverberating circuit in our pons and medulla that maintain your consciousness and focus during a wakeful state. And when the reticular formation fatigues, that's when you fall asleep, that's when you lose consciousness. So there are different levels of consciousness. So maybe there is an inhibitory pathway that is being stimulated, so certain parts of their reality just don't make sense. Okay, so sometimes it's hard to appreciate. As a matter of fact, for hyperactivity in children, we use a stimulant, all right, central nervous stimulant, and what it's stimulating is what? An inhibitory pathway, not an excitatory pathway. So that's why sometimes stimulants actually produce inhibition rather than excitation, because of the receptors that are being activated, whether they're producing EPSPs or IPSPs. Okay. All right, so norepinephrine. It's used in the peripheral nervous system as well as the central nervous system. In the peripheral nervous system, it's a sympathetic neurotransmitter. I think we're going to look at this. Remember, the autonomic nervous system has what? Sympathetic and parasympathetic. Norepinephrine is never used in the parasympathetic nervous system, but it's used in the sympathetic nervous system. In the central nervous system, it affects general level of arousal, and amphetamines, all right, stimulate norepinephrine pathways. There are some almost time to quit. Okay. There are some. These aren't really too terribly important, but there are some amino acid neurotransmitters, like glutamic acid, that's an amino acid, aspartic acid. These are major excitatory neurotransmitters in your brain and spinal cord. Glycine is inhibitory, and glycine is another amino acid. Glycine works by opening up calcium channels, which hyperpolarize the membrane. Chlorine? Where is chlorine high? So here's a membrane. This is outside the cell. This is inside the cell. And if we open a channel right here for sodium, what does that cause? Depolarization, right? All right, but now if we open up a channel like this and chlorine can enter, because chlorine is high on the outside, what's the sign of chlorine ion compared to sodium? It's opposite, right? It's opposite, so when chlorine goes in the cell, does it cause depolarization? It causes what? Hyperpolarization, which is what? That's a IPSP. Okay, so different kinds of ion channels can cause different effects, right, depending on the charge. Strychnine is a poison that blocks glycine receptors. All right, so what does a glycine receptor do? Does it stimulate or does it inhibit? It inhibits, right? So glycine inhibits. And if you block that, and these signals eventually go to muscle, all right, so it blocks that inhibition so that strychnine produces a complete paralysis or a contraction of all the muscles in your body. Okay, when you block that inhibition, you have what? Just overriding stimulation of all the muscles. And that's why it's so so dangerous and such a bad poison, because people just go into contraction, of course, and they can't breathe, and that's it. GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid, it's the most common neurotransmitter in the brain. It's inhibitory, and it's inhibitory because it produces IPSPs, because it opens chlorine channels. Okay. All right, so I think that's where I'm going to stop. Maybe I'll mention some of these things next time. But next time I'm going to at least start here with synaptic integration. And that's the last thing in this chapter. Not too much more.